The House Judiciary Committee this afternoon. We are going to deal with the agenda in an order that I think makes the most sense given some of the people that are here to testify. And so we're going to start today by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 613. I'll open that public hearing and I'll invite the Senate President, President Courtney, if you want to come forward. And your group is always welcome, Senator.
Okay. I'm going to have a chair. 6:30. Thank you. This is going to be good.
Thanks to get my tie.
Anytime you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Max Williams, and members of the illustrious, most learned House Judiciary Committee. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North. That's in Salem at 97303. And I'm a state senator. My Senate district is number 11, which includes portions of Salem and all of Brooks, Jervis, and Woodburn. I'm here today to speak in support of what has become known as Senate Bill 16, sports violence bill, a bill that was introduced on the Senate side, worked in the committee of your counterpart, the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm not going to say if I think it's as illustrious as this committee, but it's your counterpart right through that wall. It then passed out of that committee unanimously, as well as off the floor of the Senate unanimously. It authorizes sports officials the right to order a coach, a team player, or spectator to leave a sports event for conduct that is considered disorderly or threatening. Creates the crime of trespassing if a player is ordered to leave and returns. That crime would be considered a Class B misdemeanor punishable by a maximum of 6 months in prison, $2,000 fine on both. It will remove the vulnerability of sports officials who are placed in when they are asked to endure unreasonable behavior from either players, coaches, or fans. Now, to just say for the record, and I have very well-represented individuals here to talk about what is happening in the world of sports at all levels. I'm talking youth sports, I'm talking middle school, high sports, and yes, I am talking college sports. I do not have an individual here from professional sports, but what is going on there has also been very well documented as recently a few months ago in a lead article, well-known article in USA Today. It is my opinion as an individual who coached youth sports for some 11 to 12 years, who does all the PA announcing for the men and women's basketball games for Western Oregon University, that the conduct of all participants at these events has become, on the part of some, a small percentage, very threatening and is escalating. And that what we are attempting to do here is make a statement on behalf of the state of Oregon that we all want to either participate in sporting events, coach sporting events, or watch sporting events. We want to participate, we want to compete, we want to win, but we are not going to tolerate conduct of a certain kind. As recently as a few weeks ago, in my own backyard, there was a soccer game. A sports official was there who was, it is reported, and I do not see the police report, he was assaulted badly by two of the players following the game. But I must say that that was at a club level. This kind of conduct is, or near conduct, can be witnessed even at the youth sports level. Before each Western Oregon game, particularly if it's a great Northwest Athletic Conference game, I read a statement to the crowd that talks about we do not want people to use bad language and things. But the truth of the matter is, I believe that a statement saying in the state of Oregon, you need to know that the policymakers feel so strongly about this that we would allow an individual to be cited for trespass if their conduct reaches a certain level and they are asked to leave and don't do so, or leave and come back. I will now stop and allow those beside me to speak because they have been intimately involved in the levels of sports conduct that I'm talking about, and I think it'd be better, Chair, if I include my statement with that remark and then defer to these individuals who are sitting with me because they represent some interesting activities in our state, and they can speak more at length about their feelings on the bill as well as their view of where we are in sports in our society. Thank you, Mr. Chair, as well as all the members of the committee for even being allowed to come here today and for your willingness to even hear this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Do you intend to remain during the hearing?
I'd like to stay for a bit. It's important that I spend time on this side of the building.
We're glad to have you here. If you'd go next, sir, and introduce yourself, and please begin.
Chair Williams, member of this committee. My name is Alan Mulberg, and I reside at 329 McNary Estates Drive North in Kaiser, Oregon, 97303. I officiated basketball for 36 years, 21 years in the Pac-10 and West Coast conferences. I'm now the coordinator of officials for Tri-States Intercollegiate Basketball Officials Association. I assign 150 college officials to small college basketball games in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. I previously testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding SB 613. I'm very concerned with the number of incidents where spectators are becoming increasingly aggressive in their hostile actions towards sports officials. This past weekend, I attended the National Association of Sports Officials annual convention in Portland, along with Mr. Welter, and I heard of numerous incidents across the country of serious verbal and physical attacks on various sports officials. I believe that passage of SB 613A will send a clear, strong, and convincing message to the public that inappropriate, uncivil behavior and actions towards sports officials in Oregon will not be tolerated. I'm extremely pleased that the state of Oregon has taken a proactive step toward the protection of our sports officials, many of who are volunteers, rather than a reactive step. I would like to thank the members of this committee for the opportunity to give testimony and to Peter Courtney for his interest in this matter. On behalf of the officials that I represent, we would like to thank you for your consideration and hopeful passage of SB 613A. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Welter, are you next?
My name is Tom Welter. I reside at 2322 Southwest Cheever Court in Portland. I'm the executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association. The OSA is made up of 287 public and private high schools all across the state of Oregon. Each year we conduct 80 state championships in 16 different activities for our member schools. Last year, to conduct those championships, we certified over 3,300 amateur sports officials to officiate high school games at the varsity, JV, and freshman levels. Who are these officials? These officials are farmers, insurance salesmen, construction workers, ranch hands, and professional people, doctors, lawyers, circuit court judges, and even a Supreme Court justice serves as one of our officials. Most of these people don't do this as a full-time job. They love the sport they officiate, and they're giving back to their sport and to their community so that kids of today can enjoy the participation in those activities like they did. We've seen a growing number of incidents that have occurred in recent years. Let me just share a couple with you. About 5 years ago, at a high school baseball game in the Portland metropolitan area, in the second inning of the game, there was a bench-clearing brawl. By the time the umpires ejected all of the people involved in the brawl, neither team had nine players left to continue the game. So the game had to, it was a double forfeit. Both teams had to take a loss on that game. 3 years ago, we had a high school basketball game with a little over 4 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. The officials consulted with school administration from both schools and decided that it was in the best interest of all involved that the game be terminated and not play the final 4 minutes. because of the atmosphere inside the gymnasium. Those incidents are not happening just in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles. Those are incidents that are happening here in the state of Oregon. We need your help to protect our officials. If we're going to continue to have people who want to spend a lot of time for very little pay, most of them get maybe $30 to $40 a game. They're not doing this to make a living. They're doing this so that the kids of today can participate in some wholesome, healthy, and positive activities. If we don't protect them, there won't be any reason for them to come out and do that. It's not worth their time, it's not worth their effort, and it's certainly not worth their own personal health and safety. So on behalf of the officials that we certify each year, I would encourage you to strongly consider passage of Senate Bill 613. Thank you, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walter. You, sir.
Yes. My name's Mark Cottle. I'm the mayor of Sherwood, Oregon. This bill grew out of an ordinance our city started, and I'm in a little different position than the two gentlemen to my left in the sense that we were investing millions of dollars in new sports apparatuses for our community, and we were having inappropriate conduct, not just by fans, but by coaches, and the associations that regulate the coaches weren't doing much about it. And I thought it was a very difficult position for our city council to continue to invest millions of dollars and promote, we're doing this for our kids, we want to keep the kids off the street, we want this, we want that, and then having coaches or fathers or fans acting rather difficult or boorish, if you will. So what spawned that was we talked with some folks and we said, you know, what would happen if a father got out of hand or a coach got out of hand at one of these youth games and the police says, you know, it's very difficult for us. We go there if we're asked. Essentially, we have to get a bunch of people to sign a petition against the person and essentially swear out an arrest against them. And because we don't visualize it or we don't see it or don't participate in it, we have to take the sworn testimonies of all these people in order to remove or to cite the person. I thought that was too onerous on the situation at hand. We want to have a fluid game. We want to be able to control the environment. And so we started with the ordinance that has evolved into something probably a little bit better than what we came up with. I talked with our Parks Board chairman yesterday, and she reminded me this will put a little bit more onus on the city in the sense that we need to train our refs, especially our younger refs, the 14, 15, and 16-year-old refs, a little bit better on how to control the environment a little better. And I think this is a great stepping stone. You give them the tools to know that they make a decision, quite frankly, right or wrong, and there's some mechanism for that to be enforced so that we can get on with the games, we can force people, if necessary, and we hope we don't have to behave themselves. I see this as a preventive measure. I was taken to task by the Oregonians suggesting that, you know, if somebody commits a crime, they can be punished and away they go to jail. Our goal here isn't to send anybody to jail. Our goal here is just to control the environment around them and hopefully prevent anybody from going to jail. This is a preventive measure, and I hope you take it as such. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cottle. Are there questions? Representative Shetterly.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question just on the bill and ask maybe Senator Courtney his response. Looking at, do you have a copy of the bill? Line 14 on page 1, defining spectator as any person other than a player or coach who observes a sports event. I'm guessing that a lot of your problem people sometimes in these, maybe people who are not there to observe, but for other purposes entirely. And I'm wondering if attends would be a better word there than observes. I could see somebody creatively saying, well, I wasn't there to observe the game. I was just hanging out by the, I don't know where the, you know, what it might be, but somebody who may be someone that you want to get away from there who's not been observing, but just attending. And it seems to me if we broaden the definition to attend, we really enhance the scope of the bill and maybe the useful effect of it. I'm just curious about your reactions to that.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, it's a fascinating question. Now I feel like I'm being made part of your committee. And I've always
back.
And I really have I've always loved the House Judiciary Committee. It might even be a better word for another reason, and that is it's conceivable you could observe a sporting event from afar, well off the location, although I don't know if we'd cover that in the bill. And I don't think you can get, that would be, you know, staying in the same way afar, and I don't think there's got to be some limits. And the word attend may mean, actually it restricts it more to, if the word attend means more to me that you're on the premises of what they call the premises. And so maybe it would even be a better word from that standpoint, to be very frank with you. I'm not smart enough or good enough with this is one of the great judiciary committees, I'm convinced. I'm not smart enough or good enough to talk with you too much in detail today. I need a lot of time to think about that. My tummy says attend is a better word. You understand what I'm saying? My tummy tells me, and I'm not saying that to suck up to you, but my tummy tells me...
It only gets you so far in this committee.
Yeah, they say I need to spend more time here. That's right. But so I think it's a better word, I think.
Follow up, Representative Sherman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This also reminds me of a bill that we had in here a couple of weeks ago, the one that amended the criminal trespass statute to include a situation where a person has been, I think we said, excluded or directed to leave. So we're sort of covering the same ground here, but this is specific to the authority, I think, of a sports official, which is useful. My question relative to that, though, is what is the class of crime that we dealt with in that bill? I see this is a Class B misdemeanor. It seems to me we ought to make sure they're about the same, because I think they're really getting at the same conduct here.
Probably a Class C, because it's a criminal trespass in the second degree. As criminal trespass in the first degree, we Class A.
Representative Crummell, and then Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Cottle, I'm interested in the ordinance that the city of Sherwood passed from a standpoint of, I guess, first of all, a couple of questions. First of all, you wouldn't view Senate Bill 613 as being preemptive to the ordinance that you passed.
We haven't passed an ordinance yet. We, once this started down the road with the Senate, we stopped because we wanted to see what was going on there. But that's a good question, because I've been asked it by my own saying, what's that going to do to us? And I think that this is one of the good things that we need across the whole state, because it's hard. You go to Wilsonville and you behave one way and nothing happens. No offense to Wilsonville. You come to Sherwood and all of a sudden you're in jail. And so it'd be nice to have a framework all cities and counties and sports organizations could work from.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, clarify. So from a standpoint of kind of having a statewide policy with regards to what happens if somebody does attack an official at a game and that sort of thing, you think you would be in favor of this? Do you think then that local government would need to pass any additional ordinances, or would you see this as being sufficient to meet the goal that you were trying to meet with the ordinance suggested in Sherwood?
You know, from my review of it, I would suggest that my initial goal, this could take care of. I'm not suggesting that local governments give up all rights to tweak it as they see need. But I think that this starts the framework, and quite frankly, I didn't realize we were going down this grand experiment, because I've gotten calls from all over the United States that nobody else has ever tackled this issue or done something along these lines. And so I see it as a framework to start the process, Representative Crummell. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Shutterly's comments on the definition of a spectator, attends really does seem like it would be a much better inclusive word, because you're really trying to, from what I understand, focus on the conduct that's interfering with the participants or at the facility where the game's taking place, as compared to what Senator Courtney has said, something that someone may be far away that may be yelling. And if that's the case, I would suggest that would be a very clear message to be able to be sent out, and it would make it very potent for the officials who are going to be involved in enforcing this, that if someone's in attendance, that they would be covered by the bill. The other two areas, I wanted to raise one concern, and I'm not sure based on what Sherwood has done as to how this has played out, but when you look on line 23 of the bill, it says engages in inappropriate behavior. And I'm wondering if there's been any discussion regarding what inappropriate behavior would include. My concern would be free speech, as to if someone is being verbal, whether or not you're going to have a challenge that you're interfering with their right as compared to actual physical conduct, where they're having contact with somebody, even though we may not agree with what someone may be saying, you know, kill the ump, can't call, I can't see the strike zone, whatever it may be. Those type of statements, I think, would probably be protected, and you wouldn't, I don't think, necessarily would want to have that. So I'm wondering just where we can set a record and make certain that we have a clarity as to what would be potentially included within that that line.
That was a great struggle for us, but I think that Senator Courtney's done a very good job in defining inappropriate behavior. Specifically, he's relying upon past statutes that's already been passed, ORS 166.025, and then he goes into rules of conduct governing the coaches, team players, and spectators at a sporting event. And although that may change from community to community, more communities are adopting. There's I forget the name of it. There's a code of conduct that there were, for example, in Sherwood, we're requiring all parents to sign and all kids to sign prior to entering into and participating in an event. Other than that, I think that's one of those things that we're going to have to work through. But I would say that there is a balance between the right of free speech and the consequences of the speech. For example, I can't get up in a movie theater and yell fire and make everybody run out and have somebody die. Or in this room, it perhaps be inappropriate for me to yell out inappropriate things. And you would say that's not covered by the right of free speech because of the environment you're in.
And I appreciate that. Peter?
Chair Williams, Representative Sands, you'll note in line 7 through 11, we struggle with what you're talking about. That's what we did with inappropriate behavior. That's what we did. I'm open. We struggle with it mightily for a lot of reasons, and a lot of thought went into that wording. But as I say, is that the best wording? Is that all it should be? I can't tell you that.
I'm coming in here with open mind and believe that what you're bringing forward on SB 613 is something we should deal with and we should be putting on the books. I know that previously when we had the statute that's now, or the bill that made a statute for assaulting a public official, I had a lot of concern with that because I thought there's already statutes on the books that would cover that. But I also understand sometimes you need to be very specific to get that education and that message out, and it seems to me that this is another area that even though you may be able to use the current criminal trespass statute, it may be more difficult to actually show that the person that's, let's say, the umpire has the authority to exercise that power. So I think I'm with you as to moving forward, but I want to make certain that we have it as tight as we can. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I think the other part that came up is similarities. This, to me, would be very similar to criminal trespass in the second degree. It's just being much more specific to a type of area. And I would question why we would want to have a different level of offense, because I believe a criminal trespass in the second degree is only a Class C misdemeanor as compared to a Class B, and we should have some type of continuity between the two, since it's really the same conduct that we're going after. At least it appears to be, because we're trying to prohibit someone from staying on the property or re-entering the property once they've been barred from the property.
Chair Williams, Representative Zansky, could I ask your learned and high counsel to comment on that? Because he worked extensively with us on the bill.
Learned kind counsel, in response to the esteemed Senate President's query, could you comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think, I don't know if Representative Shirley brought this up, criminal trespass in the second degree is a C misdemeanor. And so this would be a higher class of crime, and would be, I think the would be Class C would be for up to 30 days in jail. This would be for up to 6 months in jail. And as a policy choice, I don't think it's up to you. It depends on what you believe is appropriate, and it would not cause any legal problems to have it as a B or C misdemeanor, because as Representative Przanski pointed out, this bill is different from criminal trespass in the sense of the elements that you have to prove. You don't have to prove, as in a criminal trespass, that the referee was made a person in charge in the same way. You just have to, you know, that you do have different elements. So I don't think there's a problem legally. It's a policy choice for the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I would point out also that in the sheet from the statute that counsel just handed to us, disorderly conduct is listed as a Class B misdemeanor. And since there's kind of a nexus between disorderly conduct and inappropriate behavior at a sporting event, maybe making the two the same might make sense. I don't know if that, you know, makes sense, but it does to me.
We do refer to disorderly conduct here on line eight. And as again, I'm not saying we know all there is. I'm not trying to. Incredible amount of thought went into this. We were scratching our head and pulling ourselves for the longest time. But we tracked a lot of things that are already in law trying to do this right. But hey, if we didn't get there, we didn't get there. So I'm not.
Well, in President Courtney, I think looking at this, one of the things that, you know, I think we can understand what 166.025 is for disorderly conduct under the statute. The subsection B, rules of conduct governing coaches, team players, and spectators at a sports event. At some point, those rules are either announced, as you've pointed out, or they're actually written rules. I know in some of the leagues that my son participates, everybody has to read the rules and sign off on the rules. It's the third one that I think, and while I don't think it creates a facial potential Article 1, Section 8 problem, it might present at some point an as-applied Article 1, Section 8 problem, which is any other conduct that interferes or threatens to interfere with a sports event. And I think at that point you get into this real gray area where your 13-year-old soccer referee may not know sort of that gray area that crosses over from something that is maybe not a bright comment, not a smart comment, but doesn't necessarily cross the line into one of these other two categories, and then he sends somebody out of the game, and all of a sudden you've got a free speech challenge because it was in a public forum on the field at a high school where the soccer game was being played on a Saturday morning. And you have that potential in this case, I think, and I'm not suggesting that we don't do it, but I am saying, and I think it's important for people to understand, that when you get into that third category where it's not terribly well defined, if a sports official takes that action and excludes somebody from the situation and then calls in law enforcement essentially to enforce that exclusion, that you've created a situation where there could be, and I think in some cases you'll find ending up being upheld, that someone has violated Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution by trying to limit someone's free speech. And it's the old fighting words exemption under Article 1, Section 8 that I think you got to be concerned about. Representative Sherrill.
Well, you know, one way to address that, we've incorporated the conduct that's defined in 166.025, disorderly conduct. We could also incorporate the conduct that's defined in 166.065, also on this page, the crime of harassment or harassment, depending on where you want to put the accent, because, for instance, that's got that incorporates the constitutional standards that are already fairly well established for that crime, and that harasses or annoys another person by subjecting them to offensive physical conduct, publicly insulting by abusive words or gestures. That seems to me something that you might find in a sporting venue. So it may be worth amending out that C that is a little bit nebulous and undefined. Why do that if we can incorporate another statute that is already on the books and probably covers the kind of conduct that you're talking about, I'm guessing. And one other, I guess I would ask, why don't we also include in this conduct that constitutes a violation of the assault of a public safety, I mean, or of a sports official? Wouldn't we want to be able to exclude a person and potentially subject them to a second criminal violation if, after assaulting a sports official, they leave and they come back to do it again?
Do that though? I thought we already had that on the. I thought we already had that. That already is on the books in another spot.
But I'm just saying,
as a civil
make that.
Yeah.
Oh, as a civil.
And make that grounds for excluding somebody from the venue, and if they violate, that they're committing this criminal act. That's just, I'm trying to incorporate all these things that are likely to happen in a sports venue without having to come up with a whole bunch of new definitions.
I mean, I recognize in the subsection C some desire to have flexibility because not everything is going to be defined within the statute. But I'm not even necessarily arguing against it. I think I'm just pointing out that I think this is potentially going to have some as-applied problems if it's used in a broad way by, you know, arguably people who aren't frankly going to understand, you know, when it crosses the line in a matter that, you know, isn't otherwise going to be protected speech in a public forum. I think that's one of the concerns.
Thank you, Chair. One of my concerns, though, is what we're seeing an increasing problem with is most of the comments have been directed as if it's a fan attacking a player or a ref, but what we're seeing a lot of problems with is actually fans combating with other fans. Whether it's inappropriate yelling across the field so everybody has to participate or listen to that stuff, or actually engaging in the problem. And the very difficult Massachusetts case was not a participant involved in killing the coach. It was a fan. And so what we're trying to do is stop fans from engaging each other also. And other than that, I think the comments are well taken, the greater definition we can do. But I'd also remind you, this is unique to the United States, this whole concept. And tinkering is part of what we do when you legislate something, that you refine it as the process goes on. Sometimes it's an expensive process, but I think this type of form, this type of bill, is exactly the type of thing that's going to be worked on as a work in progress instead of a final slam dunk and it's over with, because we're embarking upon a new course of conduct, if you will.
All right. Other comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. Mr. Welter, I'd appreciate if you'd kind of correct me if I'm wrong. But with all the legal talk, now let me bring it kind of around to the practical side of it. And that, as I sort of view this, as kind of a continuum of enforcement, if I can use that term. So if somebody at a game gets out of hand, the official really is the person in charge. At a high school, you might have an athletic director there, that sort of thing, or a college or a university, but the official is the person in charge of the game itself. If somebody in the stands, for example, at a basketball game, if somebody in the stands starts yelling things that they shouldn't be yelling at, whether it be at a player or at the coaches or at the officials, which usually become the target. The official can call a technical foul on the fan, but it actually goes to the bench, if I'm not mistaken. And so the enforcement, if you will, or the punishment, I guess, goes against the whatever team that's kind of identified that this person is sort of advocating for. And then if there's a second offense, there can be a second technical foul. But I believe that for example, in the OSAA rules, that an official can ask a spectator to leave if they don't behave themselves. And please correct me if I'm wrong. And so I'm kind of seeing this as kind of a continuum where the official has sort of run out of options. They don't really have any other options, and so they say, you know what, you can't control yourself, if it's a coach, can't control your players, or whatever the case may be, we're going to bring somebody in to remove you, and we're invoking whatever part of the statute this happens to become part of. And I guess it'll be 161.01067. But am I correct in that, I mean, do you sort of view this as being the same thing, or because what I wouldn't want to see is an official say, well, you know, you've been calling me names and I don't like it, and so I'm going to call the police to come and kick you out of here because this is a violation of state law.
Representative Williams, Representative Crummell, yeah, let me try to clarify a little bit. First of all, you know, you refer a little bit to basketball and calling technicals, but certainly we have difficulties with, you know, fan conduct at events, you know, certainly at soccer. The other thing I think it's wise to realize is that many of our events, we tend to think of the varsity football game on Friday night where there are, you know, security people and athletic directors and school administrators, But many of our events occur on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoons at a field removed from the school where, in essence, the official and the 24-year-old coach are the people in charge. You know, and the official's in charge of the contest. If they have difficulties, they are the ones that have to deal with it. There is no athletic director on site. There is no, game management person, so to speak. Certainly, we have codes of conduct for our officials. We have codes of conduct for our coaches. We have codes of conduct for our participants. I would hope that, you know, people wouldn't view this as, oh, this is going to give a sports official a hammer that they don't need. And certainly, if it's abused by a sports official, then we have to deal with that. But obviously, I was a high school athletic director for 20 years, and when officials stopped a game and motioned me to come out on the field or on the floor and said, we won't continue until that fan is gone, I would go remove him. You know, what this bill will do, it will give some authority and some credence to doing that very thing, and not, you know, some, it'll really give us some backing to be able to do that, some legal backing to do that, rather than hoping that the person is going to cooperate and having no recourse if they don't, other than to call the police and try to do that. You know, we put in, you know, a couple of sessions ago, the officials assault legislation, and we haven't had a whole number of incidents, but certainly I think people became aware of that. And so that any kind of a physical assault, they were subject to prosecution for that. And, I would hope that this would serve as a great deterrent to some of the inappropriate behaviors that we witness, at this time.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to applaud the good senator for bringing a bill of this nature and this issue before us. However, I have one really kind of major problem, and I think we're on the wrong end of the continuum here. We've got all of these kids, whether they're in a soccer league or basketball league or football league, or whether they're in high school or junior high, middle school. We've got all of these kids looking to role models. And the role models they have are on television on Sunday or Saturday afternoon with the NBA or the NFL or the major college football basketball teams, and we see behavior there. We see the kids modeling the behavior of the athletes in the moves and the, you know, that the athletes have on the playing field. It's naive of us to think that they're not modeling the behavior of the crowds and the athletes that they see in these high-paid, very sophisticated games that are there. And it's not that that I don't want to address it at this issue, but I think it's I think we're punishing in some ways the little guy in this process when we've got a $6 million man out here, spitting in the face of a participant, or not a participant, but a fan, or in the face of an official, and the list goes on. So, and I don't know whether the intention of the bill is to address in the state of Oregon those athletic events or not, but it bothers me that we're addressing it at the lower level and the little kids. And getting all of our focus of attention here in the committee at that level and not at the Duck or the Civil War game.
Quickly, because I know you got so many other things to do. Chair Williams, Representative Dennison, if this were to become law, it would be the law of the state of Oregon. It would not just apply to youth sports or high school sports. We do have professional sports team that participate in it. And should a professional athlete, regardless of the sport or the amount of money that person makes, conduct themselves in a certain way, they could come under the jurisdiction of this piece of legislation.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
And this is what I want to have for the record on this, Senator, is that We're not looking at the mom-and-pop games that are, you know, well, they apply, but we've got some other areas that this needs to apply to, and I appreciate your comment with that. Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I think the bill obviously has great purposes. I'm a little bit concerned about some of the technical aspects, as was Representative Shetterly, and to I think I can summarize my statements by saying by incorporating the disorderly conduct statute, I think maybe the net is cast a little too wide because there are several subsections there that clearly don't apply, such as congregating and refusing to disperse pursuant to an order of the police. That might not help. Initiating false or reports concerning alleged impending fires, explosions, or catastrophes. They're just things that just don't apply here. And also in the disorderly conduct, a violation is making unreasonable noise. Well, in an athletic venue, that might be hard to establish and may be also constitutionally suspect. Likewise, there's some provisions of the harassment statute which would also, I think, particularly apply in this case. And I don't know if the technical fix might be to take the best of the disorderly conduct and the best of the harassment behaviors that are prohibited that are most relevant to this venue, and that might provide a better technical fix than what we have here before us. It would broaden the base of behavior, make the behavior more statutory definable and constitutional. So that would be my overall suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Well, gentlemen, I think that the committee is interested in the bill. I think that there's probably some things that we're going to want to work with Mr. Prinz on in cooperation with your office, Senator, and anyone else that you have want to get involved in the process. But we appreciate you coming forward and testifying today and bringing the bill to the committee's attention, and we'll continue to work on the details.
Thank you, Chair. It's always a pleasure and honor to come before the House Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 613A. Waiting patiently has been our state's Attorney General, Hardy Myers. We appreciate your patience, Attorney General Myers, and we are now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 617A. And, Council, do you want to bring us up to speed on that?
I will, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have Senate Bill 617A, and we've taken testimony on this bill. You may recall it is the restitution bill that was before our committee. I think it was more than 2 weeks ago. Again, this is the bill that is sponsored by the Department of Justice that would mandate full restitution in criminal or juvenile cases. And before the committee, there are two amendments that you should have in your packet. I want to make sure that we've all got those. They are the 617-4 and -5 amendments, respectively. So, and Jane or Nancy also prepared a Hannah Gross copy of those so we could go through them. I believe Mr. Myers is here on the fours. I have these backward on the fives, so I'll go through those first, or if you'd rather have Tim go up through, Mr. Myers can go through them, I'm sure, more ably than I. Basically, we had, as you may recall, the committee talked about the policies surrounding this and also the policy decisions surrounding possibly having an ability by a defendant to, at some point, come to the court and see if they had... if they had not done all their restitution, if there might be a point where the judgment would be satisfied, because as it is written, you might remember Representative Shetterly was concerned with how long this judgment would be against the defendant in a situation, particularly with a juvenile. So the -5 amendments, if you look at the Hand and Gross bill, if you have the Hannah Gross bill of -5s, if you look on page 5, this would create an ability for the court to reconsider whether full restitution should be paid, and I want to go through that. On page 5, the -5 amendment would allow a person who's required to pay restitution under subsection 1 of this section to to file an affidavit for satisfaction of the judgment or supplemental judgment requiring payment of restitution if they have made at least 50% of the monetary obligation has been paid and at least 10 years have passed since the original judgment was entered and the person has substantially complied with all established payment plans. Again, when we changed, the bill varies from the current statute in that the discretion to the court on how restitution would be paid would be limited to the payment plan. They would, the court would enter the judgment for the full amount of restitution for the damage that was done to the victim and then take into consideration the financial situation of the defendant upon the payment plan that is set up through the court. That's what's referred to in lines 8 and 9 of page 5 of the Hanna-Gross bill with the dash 5s. So if the person's paid 50%, it's been 10 years, they've paid all their payments, and they have not been found to have committed another crime or another juvenile offense, and they've completed their probation. If all those things are in place, they may make a motion. The district attorney would then take that motion and notify the victim. The victim would have the opportunity to object to that motion to have it satisfied. If the victim does not object, the court shall hold a hearing on the motion and may enter an order granting a full or partial satisfaction if the motion is true. So that's the dash fives. Mr. Attorney General, if I made anything, got anything wrong, please excuse me.
Why don't we have Attorney General Myers come forward, if you would, and then if you want to add anything to Counsel Prince's explanation of the A5s, then we'll let Representative Shetterly make comments on the A4s and take committee comments. Is that appropriate?
Of course, Chair. All right.
Proceed.
Two clarifications. These both A4 and A5 amendments apply only to offenders who were youth offenders at the time that they created the loss that is subject to the restitution. These amendments don't apply to those who were adults at the time of the offense. And then the 10-year or 50% satisfaction, those are alternative. I think it may have sounded as if they were supplemental to each other, but those are alternative conditions as to the eligibility of the offender. Chair Williams, do you want me to go on briefly to address the merits of the A5 version?
Yeah, would you please?
Before Representative Shetterly addresses the A4s. Both versions of these were spawned by concerns that Representative Shetterly had raised at the initial hearing with respect to youth offenders. And I, by the way, appreciate very much our opportunity to work with Representative Shetterly to see if we could arrive at a consensus set of recommended amendments for you that would address his concerns. We almost did it. The difference we'll discuss in just a moment. But again, the basic policy direction that this bill invites the legislature to take with regard to both adult offenders and youth offenders is that the standard in Oregon is going to be full accountability for losses that are eligible for restitution. So that's going to be the standard. And upon further discussion, in light of the concerns that Representative Shetterly raised, it seemed to me and to others working actively on this bill that it would be a reasonable departure from that standard to create some ability for those who were youth offenders when they caused the loss to engage what I'll call a second look, since that's part of our vocabulary in other contexts these days as it relates to youth offenders. And the disagreement between the two amendments is the question of whether the victim will have the right to, in effect, veto the access to that judicial consideration by the offender. The A5s provide the victim that role. The A4s do not. Otherwise, they are identical, the two amendments. Now, bearing in mind, again, as I said, that the fundamental policy thrust of the underlying bill is full accountability for all offenders, it's straightforwardly a policy issue for the committee as to, and the assembly, as to how far it wants to depart from that standard as it relates to those who were youth offenders when they caused the loss. In my view, and I think I could say truthfully the view of at least most of the task force, it is a much, much larger departure from full accountability if we permit a process by which, even over the victim's objections, the system can transfer the responsibility, in effect, for the loss from the wrongdoer back to the victim. Because the wrongdoer is the guilty party here, not the victim. And it's our view and our respectful recommendation to you that if you otherwise agree that this second look process is a reasonable adjunct to the bill as to youth offenders, that you not depart from full accountability, the principle of full accountability, to the extent that the A4s would permit, and that you retain the victim in the position of saying, I believe I should receive full restitution. Again, by definition, it is the offender who is the wrongdoer here, and the victim who is the innocent party. And no matter what conditions you attach, if the offender is relieved of the restitution burden, it shifts back to the victim. So again, Mr. Chair, it's my respectful recommendation to the committee that you adopt the A5 amendments, and then, of course, I hope would forward the bill as amended with your support.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Representative Shetterly to discuss the A4 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, too, appreciate the Attorney General's work on this. I think we came to a point where we realized there was at least a fork in the road and recognized what that was, and I think understood the choices, which he, I think, accurately described to the committee. And I guess my purpose in putting forth the A4s is not to demean in any way the victim's role or to diminish the victim's role in this process, but to recognize that in a criminal prosecution, even the pleadings are in the name of the state of Oregon. There is a broader interest. There's a broader array of interests here that it's appropriate for a court to take into account. I think especially in the situations we talked about where an offense has been committed by a juvenile, and you attach these conditions that we are in agreement on, 10 years, substantial compliance with all of the terms. What concerns me about the dash A4s is the in the direction that they go, and the bill was going in the first instance, was the total usurpation of the judicial role and judicial discretion here in assessing restitution and the ability then on that even the 10-year look back to make an independent determination on behalf of the concerns again that are broader than just the victim. That is the state's interest in this that has to take into account I think other considerations as well, and I think that the A4s appropriately balance those interests, especially as we talked about in the earlier meetings about how this would apply and the potential impacts that this could have on a juvenile and that juvenile's ability, even in a first offense situation, to restore his or her life, get a college loan, get a first house loan, get a car loan, and ever hope to become a productive and rehabilitated member of society. And I think that's where the state's interests come in and are worth being taken into account 10 years post-offense with the kind of good record that's required even to get a hearing in front of a judge to ask for this kind of relief. I think this recognizes a place for the state and a place for the judiciary to have a say while respecting both the victim's interest but also the broader interests in this.
Okay, thank you. Questions or comments by committee members? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the work everybody's done on that, but I'm the Dash 5s look better to me because I think we want to make the victim whole. I mean, that's in a person, especially if they're younger and they get it, they have some kind of an indebtedness over one of these things. By the time they're 25, if they do it at 15, they may just be coming into their earning years, and where they could continue to pay some monthly amount to square up with the innocent victim. I'm also concerned that, and I understand your concern about the person like college and so on, but if I get burned out or something, my business, maybe my kids can't go to college because I have to sink everything I have back in trying to restore my business, that the criminal, the defendant, has taken away from me. So I would like to have that paid back. And I just think that part of the philosophy of making the victim whole is important. And I don't think I like the idea that the victim could say, gee, this has gone far enough, and I am willing to set it aside. I foresee that otherwise 10 years are up and haven't been in any more trouble, they're going to quit making payments. People will quit making payments. And I don't like that idea.
Representative Sherrill?
Well, thank you. And Representative Barker, you raise a good question there, you know, about the impact on your business, you know, that you've lost your business. Those are precisely the kind of considerations that the court should take into account. Now, are you right for every case, in every case, subsequent to the effective date of this legislation? I don't know that balance, I don't know that is the correct assessment in every case that is going to be prosecuted to a conviction and a determination of restitution. And that's the part that concerns me about totally removing judicial discretion and consideration of these other factors. I mean, you may be right. And that is a matter then of presenting that to the court for consideration. But it concerns me that what we are doing with this bill is making the determination that in every case, that's the way the equities should fall. From in every case that's prosecuted after the effective date of this bill, and I don't feel like I have the wisdom and the foresight to be able to say that in every case that is exactly how the outcome should be. And that's where judicial discretion comes in, allowing the court to consider the equities and the interests of the broader interests of the state and of public justice, as well as the personal interest of the victim and the concerns about the status of the offender at that point in time.
Okay. Representative Barker, then I'm going to go to Representative McPherson, then to Representative Ackerman.
And
to Representative Anderson.
Representative Sherman, I appreciate that aspect of it. I view sometimes the judicial discretion I've seen in my police career sometimes as judicial, what I would call maybe inaccurately, but judicial abuse, where it has more to do with who the kid's daddy is than what the offense was and who the victim was. And so I see this as kind of a level playing field, and it does take away some discretion, but I don't see that as all bad. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I side on the same position or the same side of this issue as Representative Barker, although maybe for different reasons. I believe that there is an appropriate place for judicial discretion, and I think that is appropriately focused on the investment of our public resources through the correction system, for example, to see to the appropriate punishment and rehabilitation of the criminal offender. I see restitution as really being something apart from that, which is a matter between the victim and the perpetrator, administered by the court and the criminal justice system. And I think that in that area, the judicial discretion is not appropriately applied. So I would say that the A5s are the preferable form of amendment in this case.
All right, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I think it's fairly consistent within our criminal justice system that defendants convicted of crimes are given certain incentives to improve and rehabilitate themselves. In a situation where persons are incarcerated, they have, in many instances, opportunities to earn good time credits for early release. Certainly, if they're on probation or parole, they have a multitude of conditions which must be met in order for them to relieve themselves of that obligation. And I think it should be consistent, therefore, that we give juvenile offenders some incentive to comply with court orders. I think there's a disincentive if the defendant would know that he or she could meet the 50% requirement or wait out 10 years and substantially comply with payment schedules and lead a clean life and earn all of these benefits, and yet find that the victim could veto his or her hearing before a judge in order to determine whether further relief should be granted. Of course, there's no guarantee that relief would be granted. So I feel it's more consistent with our efforts to rehabilitate and criminal defendants that I would support the objectives of the Dash 4 amendments with the full understanding that that doesn't mean that the relief is going to be granted. It just means that there will be a full hearing on the record. The court would have to make that decision on a case-by-case basis with the defendant and the victim in court.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with many of the remarks that Representative Ackerman has made in terms of the sentence, but it's really the full sentence that the defendant has been charged with or the crimes that he'll have to pay for, not just half of it. And it would seem to me that he has to carry out the full sentence, except if there's an emotional feeling on the part of the victim that at some point these could be ameliorated and reduced. And for me, it turns a little on the emotional value to the victim that they have a chance to see where this defendant, where the criminal has changed in heart or has changed in spirit, that that they have a chance to say, well, you know, Judge, I think the penalty should be reduced or lightened or changed in some way. But it's really the feeling of the victim that I think the original law had in mind, and recompensing them, and therefore I would say the Dash 5s in my mind are more reasonable.
All right. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I look at both these amendments. I'd love to see what I would call a Dash 4 and a half. It almost seems like we need to blend part of this together. And it's, the arguments, I have not taken a position as to where I'll be on this, because I think there's been great arguments and discussions that we've had today on the different merits of the two amendments. I mean, clearly it seems like if you are going to set up a procedure where the offender could, in fact, ask the court for a reconsideration on the restitution, then it would seem to me that if the victim agreed not to object or was in agreement with the victim, it should automatically be able to be entered by the court. But if not, then it seems like you would take what would be the Dash 4s and set up the hearing that Representative Shugley has in that perspective. But the one part that I guess is making me really think twice about this is the part of what restitution, from my perspective as a prosecutor, is set up. It's like it shortens the burden on a victim to go through the civil court to get judgment for the injury that's been done to them, and that they can, in fact, ask for the criminal court to impose what would be, in fact, their right to go through the civil procedure and get a civil judgment. If a civil judgment is entered against an individual, that person is obligated to make those payments and comply with that judgment unless the creditor, for whatever reason, decides to forego getting that money or getting repaid. And so as much as I question why would you set up an expectation for an individual to, quote unquote, do the right thing and then only have one person make a decision as to whether or not they should be released from that additional or that continuing obligation being a money judgment against them because how they performed. It just seems to me that our policy decision is really, do we look at restitution as a form of the criminal sentence that's, you know, part of the judgment as a penalty, or do we see it as an extension of the civil judgment process? And I mean, when you look at the law, it's my interpretation is that
the restitution is that hybrid. It's in the criminal justice arena, but it's really giving the victim the ability to not have to go through the civil process to get that judgment that they would have the right to.
Okay.
That should cloud up.
Yeah, well, I just was trying to figure out in my counting, Representative Brzezinski, where that puts you, and I'm still not sure. Representative Shetterly.
Yeah, I think Representative Brzezinski has touched on really what is the fundamental policy change in this statute or in this bill, and that is the language that's deleted under either of the amendments on lines 14 to 17 that do substantially personalize the restitution judgment, that is, and make it more like a civil judgment of damages. If you look at the language on 14 to 17 of page 2, that's where I'm referring, where in this, you know, under current law, it's clearly the province of the criminal justice system where the court is directed to consider the ability of the defendant to pay on an installment basis and the rehabilitative effect of the defendant of restitution, you know, where those things are to be taken into account by the court. This bill deletes those considerations entirely and mandates in every case that restitution be imposed without regard to those. I think that is what makes the 10-year balancing appropriate in this case, because those factors are not taken into account at the front end. Restitution is mandated in every case now under the terms of this bill, and that is a big shift in policy. And it seems to me appropriate then, especially in these juvenile cases, to provide a balancer at that 10-year point, subject to the offender's good conduct and performance of their restitution obligation for that 10-year period. And to me, that's a fair balancing, where you are taking away those considerations at the front end, which so far which are embedded in the law.
Anything to add, Mr. Attorney General?
Chair Williams, only to reiterate that the new policy that's being invited by the underlying bill is full accountability as the standard, and the issue here is deviation from that. And again, it's my view that the extent of that deviation should not go to the point that it permits the burden of the loss to be shifted back to the victim from the wrongdoer against the victim's wishes. That the opportunity otherwise to seek relief with the victim's concurrence supporting that, but that the victim should not be allowed to be overridden in relation to that full accountability being carried out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
Well, if I could ask the Attorney General, if this became law of the Dash 5s, and if an individual, let's see if I said that right, if an individual victim went through the process of getting a civil judgment for the injury or damage they received, how would that play out in the sense that I'm probably got the Dash amendments wrong. What I'm trying to factor in is if the criminal court had the authority to relieve them of their obligation, that obligation would still be there if there had been the civil judgment entered against them?
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Okay. Well, just one question, too, I guess. Hardy, I don't know. You have a criminal judgment of restitution. If the victim obtains also a civil judgment for the same conduct, do the payments on the criminal judgment of restitution apply to reduce the civil judgment?
Yes.
They do. Okay.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Well, committee, we have two well-stated discussions on policy issues. We have a Dash A4 and a Dash A5 amendment in front of us. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Let's get a vote. I'll move the Dash A4s.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash A4 amendments to House Bill 617. We've had the discussion, so unless there's any objection from members of the committee, I'm simply going to have Nancy call down the roll on the A4s.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Nay.
Barker?
No.
Jensen?
Aye.
Hummel?
No.
McPherson?
No.
Kozanski?
No.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
No. The A4s fail.
Mr. Chair, I move the A5s.
Representative Barker moves the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 617. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Powell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Kozanski?
Aye.
Charlie?
No.
Chair Williams?
Votes aye. The A5 amendments are adopted. Chair would move the amended version of Senate Bill 617 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I didn't say anything during the discussion of the amendments, but I think the bill that we've constructed it with the A5 amendments, what we have done is that we really have given not only the opportunity for restitution to the victim, but we haven't placed the victim back in a position of being a victim a second time around. The other thing that I think that we've done, so in essence what we've done is that we have empowered the victim in that respect. I think that full accountability is something that we have started missing in a lot of sectors of our society, one of which is our school system. I think we're starting to get that back, and I think it's passing statutes like this that helps us to get there. And with the amendments in there, I wholeheartedly support the bill.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Yes, I'm going to support the measure. As it comes out of committee, I'm going to reserve judgment on supporting the measure on the floor, lacking the background that some of you have in the law. I have to look at this a little more carefully before I can make that commitment.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Tansky.
Mr. Chair, I will be supporting the motion to move the bill to the floor. I will put on the record at this point my my decision at this point was based on what the civil judgments would provide for if an individual victim had gone through the civil court and received a judgment against an individual juvenile or family member, however it may be, the guardian. That would be one that would stay in law. But I do want to recognize Representative Shutterly's concern, and this is the part I'm going to debate between now and the floor, that we have also shifted where the court does not have the discretion at the front end as to determining on the amount of restitution, where in a civil proceeding, the court would in fact be able to have a determination as to what was the appropriate amount. I think the court really does still have that ability to make that decision as to what is appropriate based on the information that it is brought before the court and in the criminal proceeding, and then he or she, meaning the judge, will make the decision as to what the appropriate amount of restitution, then they would be fully accountable for that amount. But I will be supporting the bill.
Representative Shirley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support the bill out of the committee, but with grave concerns about the unintended policy consequences of this, evisceration of judicial discretion, both in the imposition and then in any opportunity to review the judgment from a broader public justice considerations. And reflecting on Representative Przanski's comments, we do have two systems. One is civil and one is criminal. And I'm troubled that this represents, I think, to me, a troublesome blending of the two, when really they were created for two entirely different purposes.
Thank you. I want to thank both Representative Shetterly and Attorney General Myers for their work on the bill since we first heard it. I think regardless of the concern and the difference when we came down to the final version of the amendment that are adopted, the discussion and the amendment that we did adopt at least made some progress down the road to the issues that were raised originally as concerns by the committee. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate this committee's engagement. And given our willingness to spend lengthy times discussing this today, it's clear that we're not having meetings regularly enough because we really
I would have taken time on
spend quite a bit. of time today on these. But with that, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Carmel?
Aye.
Matusa?
Aye.
Bazanski?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Was it me? I'm sorry. I was interrupted. Okay, it's me. I vote aye. Senate Bill 617 is amended, moves to the floor with due pass recommendation. I'll sign the bill to Representative Barker to carry. Our next bill is going to be a work session on Senate Bill 752. Again, this is a bill involving Attorney General Meyer, and so if you would please take us through, counsel.
I will, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate Bill 752, we had testimony back in, believe it or not, May 28th, seems like a long time ago. This is the bill that deals with the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund. And I believe this the Attorney General here is here on the A5 amendment, and Mr. Fiscom is here. You may recall that there was some technical look at this. I want to make sure that the interplay with this and insurers and payment of the for this these assessments, medical assessments of sexual assault victims was done correctly the bill speaks to that. If you have the A5 amendment, basically we've taken and starting through again, section 1 is the same. Section 2 is the portion that has been amended to deal with insurance issues that a provider, if you look at the amendment, I have the amendment itself rather than the hand engrossed. It's almost easier to look at the amendment itself. Line 13 of page 2, a provider who submits a bill under this subsection may not bill the victim or the victim's insurance carrier for the medical assessment except to the extent the department is unable to pay the bill due to lack of funds or declines to pay the bill. I believe this is the Attorney General's office drafted this to alleviate Mr. Fiscom's concerns that he put on the record last time. In lines 17 to 20, a provider may not charge the department for more for a complete medical assessment or partial medical assessment than the maximum amounts established by the department by rule. So this would make that part of the rulemaking process, as opposed to the bill that, as it came over, had a set amount for that. And then the bill in then would give the department rulemaking authority. The bill then also puts a sunset on this provision of January of 08, and then makes it goes into effect March 1 of 2004, but allows its AG's office time to implement this before then.
Okay. Mr. Attorney General, you want to come forward? Why don't I bring Mr. Fiscom up at the same time? That way we can just get this on the record. Do you have anything you want to add beyond Mr. Prinz's?
Chair Williams, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. only that the amendments that were reviewed have arisen from a process of discussion with providers and insurers. It's been a very collaborative, friendly process, and I think they are improving amendments that we certainly commend to the committee.
Okay. Mr. Fiscom.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiscom. My clients for this purpose are Providence Health System, which includes Providence Health Plans as well as PacifiCare, and subject to frowns from my colleagues who are behind me that you can see, I will come partially close at least to speaking for them as well. Concur with the Attorney General that we've spent a number of meetings talking about these issues. We're prepared to support this approach. We appreciated his consideration of interests relative to hospital billing practices as well as health insurance claims practices. The amendments before you reflect our agreement. We would have preferred in some ways a general fund approach to respond to this major problem in Oregon, but we understand why that's not possible this time, and thus we are prepared to support these amendments, and we appreciate the consideration, including the report to the next session that the Attorney General has indicated his willingness to provide, and it's in the bill, plus the sunset. pluses. Your council has said the preference of the hospital industry in Oregon was to deal with the Attorney General on the rulemaking side of things relative to the fee schedule associated with reimbursement practices or billing practices from a hospital to the fund. And then the language your council talked about relative to when the fund is out of money or when an inappropriate bill comes to the fund, then that would call into play the hospital billings to insurers if those insurers of a sexual assault victim are in fact known. That said, Mr. Chair, we're prepared to move ahead with this, and we appreciate the Attorney General's consideration at various points along the way. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Fiskum or for the Attorney General on the Dash 5 amendments to the bill? Okay. Hearing none, thank you both very much. Committee, we're in work session. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're in work session, I had some proposed amendments, which I'm not putting forward today, at the request of several different people for different reasons. But I strongly believe that this needs to have under 3B, the offering of requested provision of prescriptions for sexually transmitted disease prevention and emergency contraception. It's not abortion. It would prevent the establishment of a pregnancy, would not disrupt an established pregnancy. And I'm appalled that that's taken out. I'm concerned about the rape victims, the women who've been raped by a stranger or by somebody they know or by a brother or a father. And I believe those belong in there. Since they're not in there, I'm going to will be voting no today in committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Anybody else? All right, with that in mind, the chair then will move the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 752. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the adoption of the amendment? Well, do you want to be shown as a no vote on the adoption of the amendment? So yeah. Show Representative Barker is objecting to the adoption of the A5 amendment. Is there anybody else?
I also.
Oh, and okay. Representative Anderson objects to the adoption of the A5 amendment. Okay, so there's two no's. I think that still gives me enough. The A5s are in the bill. Chair would move Senate Bill 752A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm going to be voting in the affirmative in committee to get the bill out. I recognize the statements that have been made, and I'm going to think about it as to reserving my right to vote no on the bill on the floor.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Yes, I'll support the bill to move out, too, but I am reserving my right to vote on the floor.
All right. Well, we're almost unified in that, it sounds like. Okay. So the motion is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
No.
Jensen?
Aye.
Hummel?
Excused.
McPherson?
Excused.
Hummel?
Aye.
Chernovich?
Aye.
Sherwood?
Aye. Senate Bill 752A as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I can't ask any of that end of the table to carry the bill because they don't know what they're going to do with it when they get to the floor. Representative Ackerman, are you comfortable carrying it?
Not quite, no.
Sounds like a good one for the chair.
Party, you want to carry this one? Well, with that, then, I will defend the work of the Attorney General on this bill and assign the bill to me to carry.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
And I would like to also reserve the right on the floor.
Great. Everybody's reserved their rights. So be it. Well, this committee's taken an interesting turn this afternoon.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrilling?
You know, this always happens after the committee party.
Yeah. It sure does.
You give them their rewards and they turn on you.
All right. Yeah, why don't we thought that we were looking for Senator Brown, who we think is on her way to lead off on Senate Bill 610, but we don't see her yet.
Yeah, it's coming.
So I guess we're going to do 820. So we'll start with a work session on Senate Bill 820. Mr. Taylor, do you want to come forward?
Chair, members of the committee, you have the GAS 12 amendments in front of you, which are intended to be a substitution for the Senate Bill 820B. And I know Representative Jensen is more familiar with this than I am, but what we will do is amend in two bills that were passed out of the House with pretty substantial margins and are now locked up in the Senate. The Dash 12 amendments relate to water issues in the Deschutes Basin.
All right. Committee, this is a somewhat unusual bill, I think, for the Judiciary Committee to have in its possession. We took the bill at the request of the chair of the Water Committee as the bill was re-referred back to this committee from the floor of the House. It's our pleasure to have the chair of the House Water Committee on our committee as a member of this committee, and it seemed like a reasonable request to get this bill. We now have a Dash B-12 amendment, is that right? Mm-hmm. And so, Representative Jensen, I guess I'd start by asking you to give the committee some introduction to the bill, and then I was going to allow some other folks who were interested to come up and talk to the B-12s. And I don't know who that is, but I'd like to see a show of hands.
Mr. Riggs, I think, and Mr. Sussman.
Okay, so a couple of people are here for the yeah. B-12s. All right. So take us away, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As Able Counsel has said, Senate Bill 820 was a bill that basically was going to die in the House Water Committee. And in order to preserve it for either a purpose of this type or for perhaps a purpose of the original proponents of the bill coming to an agreement before the end of the session, we wanted a place for it to rest where we could have access to it in the event that it was needed. It appears on the scene now that it has been needed, and I'm referring you to House Bill 3215 and House Bill 3217, which have to do with water rights and water transfers in the Deschutes Basin. And House Bill 3215 passed the House with a vote of 54-1, and House Bill 3217 passed out of the House with a vote of 54-0. The bills are both 3215 and 3217 are essentially, I think, non-controversial. I believe that there are some folks with the water districts here that may be here to also testify on this, but I think everybody of the users or stakeholders or whatever the terminology is were in agreement on the bills. And what happened in the Senate is that the Senate had Senate committee that had it did not had difficulty getting through their agenda, got locked up for reasons known only to the Senate and not of concern to us here, I don't think. And since it the bill was a good bill, was widely worked by all of the participants, all of the interested parties in it, and had a number of work group sessions before we took it to work session in the committee. So I feel very comfortable about these two bills, and I feel that they're two that are very badly needed. And I really, Mr. Chair, would like the two gentlemen to come up and give us a quick, if you want, if the committee members want, a very quick overview of 3215 and 3217.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Representative Jensen. I think it would be instructive to the committee to be a bit better informed about the details of the bill. And one of my questions is, just to make sure that it wasn't one of us, was were any of us the one no vote?
No, Mr. Chair, no, we were not amongst the exalted no vote.
Okay,
on that.
Good. Well, all right. It's just always good to records, right? Yeah, always good to know where you were before. If you two would come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate your forbearance here, and I want to express, for the record, Doug Riggs here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. For those of you who don't know, COCO is Bend, Redmond, Madras, Metolius, Sisters, and Culver, and we have worked very closely with the department and with the chairman of the Water Committee in the last two sessions to come up with bills that would both assist our municipalities, which are experiencing rapid growth, as well as provide conservation tools to incentivize water conservation and mitigation. In the last session, we passed a landmark water mitigation bill that's gone through the rules-making process and is currently being implemented, which we think will provide tremendous benefits from an environmental standpoint. This session, we wanted to follow up and come up with a couple of additional tools that would allow cities and irrigation districts and agriculture users to be able to work together to put our limited amount of water in the Deschutes Basin to better use and more efficient use. So what I've handed out is testimony that will give you a few more details than our oral testimony will give you about exactly what the bills do. I think in short fashion, what I'd like to do is emphasize the process as well. Chairman Jensen referred to a series of work groups. We had four work sessions and one additional hearing only on the bills in the Water Committee. We had five work group meetings that lasted probably 20, 25 hours. We had extensive negotiations. At the end of the process, what we ended up with was two bills that both passed the committee unanimously. As Chairman Jensen referred to, we had one no vote, which was unrelated, I think, to this bill. Same rep cast a no vote on, I think, all the bills that day. So I don't think there was any controversy or opposition. Just so you know, I've also spoken with Vice Chairman Ringo. We've spoken to Chairman Ferrioli, who are the chairs and the vice chair of the committee in the Senate. I don't think
that. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, but this bill will not go back to that committee. This bill will go to Senator Metzger and Senator Nelson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I just wanted to make sure that people understood that the substantive committee chairman in the Senate had agreed with the policy, and these bills actually were on a list that was supposed to be moved, but circumstances overtook it. So I don't think there's any controversy with the bills. Maybe what I'll do is close. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the substance, but maybe I'll let Adam Sussman with the department focus on that a little more in detail.
Mr. Sussman.
Yes, good afternoon. Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Adam Sussman. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Water Resources Department, and I just want to reiterate a couple points that I think have already been made. One is that we have worked very hard with the proponents of this bill, particularly on the House side, and we did support both House Bill 3215A and 3217A as they were moving through the process. We've also been in close communication with the governor's natural resources staff, and they are also not opposed to these two bills. I guess what I wanted to do is just give you the gist of what these two bills do, and what they really do is provide a greater amount of flexibility to modify or transfer water rights within the Deschutes Basin, and it really is in two areas. One is in the ability to modify a water right where you can take, you can go from a surface water diversion to a groundwater diversion, provides greater flexibility there, and then also provides greater flexibility to temporarily modify or temporarily transfer a water right from irrigation to municipal use. And again, what these bills try to do is just add to the toolbox so that the municipal water providers in the basin, which are facing significant growth, can find the water resources that they need to serve the community. I guess the other thing I wanted to add is that this additional flexibility that's provided by these bills does not reduce in any way the existing protections for both existing water rights and for the groundwater resource. And the department does support both of 3215 and 3217.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, are there questions for either of these witnesses? Okay. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And you were the only two who raised your hands when I asked if there was anybody else who wanted to talk to these bills. I don't see any other takers. All right. With that, then, Representative Jensen, as we move along on our agenda.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -812s to Senate Bill 820.
Is it the B-12s?
B-12.
The B-12s. Representative Jensen moves the -B-12s to Senate Bill 820. Is there any further discussion by members of the committee? Is there any objection to the adoption of the B-12s? B-12s are in the bill, showing Representative Krummel and McPherson is excused. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Senate Bill 820 as amended with the -B-12s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves Senate Bill 820 as amended by the -B-12s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Seeing none, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Everson?
Aye.
Marker?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Slavsky?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 820, as amended by the B-12s, will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation with Representative Jensen assigned to carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. Now we will go to Senate Bill 610. I'll open a public hearing and invite Senator Kate Brown, the Democratic leader in the Senate, to come forward.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown, I represent Senate District 21, a little bit of Northeast Portland, Southeast Portland, and the city of Milwaukee. Thanks very much for giving this bill a hearing today. It's Senate Bill 610. Under current law, crime victims are allowed to attend court proceedings without fear of losing their jobs. This bill simply expands the definition of crime victim to include members of the immediate family. Your Senate committee did limit it to members of the immediate family. It doesn't make any sense, frankly, that supportive family members cannot be present at these proceedings when their loved ones are victims of violent crimes. The bill was originally limited to ballot measure 11 crimes. It's come to my attention that it did not include aggravated murder. Okay, so we blew it on the Senate side. And there's also been discussion about broadening it to include person-to-person felonies. So I believe you have both of those amendments in front of you. I think it's fair to say that the biggest concern raised in the Senate was the impact on businesses. I can't tell you that there would be no impact. It's our understanding that 9 out of 10 businesses allow this unpaid leave in any event. And we did have a hardship provision that allows an employer to prevent an employee taking time off if it creates a significant burden to the employer. So I think this is a really important little bill, and I would urge your support. I would be happy to answer any questions, and I really appreciate you giving it your time and energy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Are there questions for Senator Brown? Okay. Do you
want
to stick around and for
as
some
as long as I can, I will. Thank
okay.
you.
I have. Why don't we bring him up in threes? Rebecca Gandy. Craig Plunkett and Ann Pratt, if you three had come forward. Nancy. Rebecca, do you want to begin?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Rebecca Gandy. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I have written testimony here, and I know there are a lot of other people who want to testify. So I just want to say that for the survivors who will be impacted by this bill, the opportunity to attend proceedings without fear of losing their job for that reason will provide them with a measure of validation, a sense of inclusion, and maybe even a sense of closure, which can aid enormously in the healing process. And we urge you to pass this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gandy. Ms. Pratt, welcome.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Pratt, and I'm here with Crime Victims United. I've been asked to read Marie Armstrong's testimony, who was unable to be here. This is someone who did have a problem in the workplace, and this is her testimony. Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'm a member of Madden, a member of Crime Victims United, and a crime victim. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 610. On March 8, 1996, my life changed forever when a drunk driver killed my son, Chance. He was only 20. This testimony is not about what happened that terrible night, but what happened afterwards in my workplace. I was employed by the Cottage Grove Hospital at the time and was able to have 2 weeks of bereaved time. The hospital gave me 1 week, and my friends and fellow employees donated another week. A month after returning to work, everything started to change. I was told to stop grieving. It was necessary for me to converse with sheriff's deputies, district attorney's office, and my attorney on a regular basis for at least the first year and a half. Sometimes it was hard to do everything that needed to be done after 4:30 when I was off of work, but I made every effort to do so. When my review came up, I was told I had to stop grieving again, change my thinking, and that I was not the same person. I tried to tell them I had changed and that I was not the same person because of the death of my son, but I was doing my job, I was at work on time, and was not making mistakes. And I was not perfect even before my son was killed. A coworker also harassed me to an almost unbearable point, once insisting that I had made a serious error. I was not even in the office that day, and then I had to explain why. I was burying my son that day. All this time, I expected another coworker to speak up and take responsibility for the error. But when it was over, she said that it was good that I spoke up and said where I was. I felt that I had nowhere to turn for help within my workplace, and I needed my job. Marie states she could go on and on with other instances, but she says, "Well, I did not lose my job. I was continually harassed and intimidated. I would like to ask the committee this question. How would you want to be treated in your workplace? If you could walk a mile in our shoes for just a moment, you would know why Senate Bill 610 is so important." Crime victims should be allowed to conduct crime-related business if necessary, attend trials and criminal proceedings without fear of harassment or being fired. We as crime victims have had our own worst nightmare come true. As adults, we want everything to go smoothly, but it doesn't always. This is real life. The human body handles extreme stress and pain in different ways, and everyone is different. Why was everyone around me thinking that I should be able to get on with my life? I was in shock, denial, pain, and grief that I had never experienced before in my life. It has been 7 years since my son was killed, and I can honestly say it will take me the rest of my life. Each year brings additional understanding for myself and how far I've come in my shock and grief. Corporations need to have training and understanding of that shock that a person goes through, and it will take time. Unfortunately, I believe we are becoming a majority and not the minority as we once were, or this bill would not be in front of you now. I plead with the committee to pass Senate Bill 610. I hope and pray that you will never need this bill. Thank you for your time and attention. Sincerely, Marie Armstrong. And I do have copies of Marie's testimony that I would like to submit for the record also.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt.
Thank you.
Mr. Plunk.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Plunkett. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and parents of murdered children. My story begins with the death of my son, Eric Plunkett. Eric was murdered on September 28, 2000. And He was murdered in his dorm room at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. 4 months later, another child, another student, was also murdered. His name was Ben Varner, and he was from San Antonio. He was also murdered in his dorm room, too. Gallaudet is the only liberal arts college for the deaf and hard of hearing in the world. And Eric was, he was easy prey for the person that actually murdered him, because he had cerebral palsy. He was deaf, and he, so he couldn't hear anyone coming up in back of him, but he had cerebral palsy. And so the student, the other student, strangled him from behind and beat him over the head with a chair. Time of Eric's murder, I was working for a company in the Portland area, and I'd been working there for a little, almost 4 years. I was, and I was expected to work 47 hours a week. I took 2 weeks off to bury Eric and go to all the memorials in Minneapolis and Gallaudet in Washington, D.C. And the first week back, I could only work a half a day. I thought that by pushing a longer period of time, it was going to jeopardize my work if I was going to be able to grieve any longer. 2.5 months after I buried Eric, my employer came up to me out of work, followed me out to my car, and he told me to get over it, get over the my son's murder. His exact words were, "Get over your son. I don't want to hear you mention his name." And he told me that the business was only there to make money, and he wanted 100% from me. And after that, I felt intimidated, because that's the way he came on to people. That was his management style, of being intimidating. I didn't want to take time off and go to the pretrial hearings because I was afraid that I was going to be discharged. I did go to a couple of memorials at Gallaudet that was held for Ben and Eric in February. I was also called back to D.C. for the grand for a grand jury sometime in February of 2001. My wife and I attended Eric's attended the dedication of Eric's dorm room as the Eric Plunkett Video Library in September 2001. And at all these times, I used my vacation time. Trial started in April 21st, 2002, in D.C. By that time, I knew that I was going to either get fired when I was back in D.C. at the trial, or probably the first day back at work. I took 5 weeks off, and it was I took that off as leave of absence. The first day back, my employer called me into the back room, and he asked me what my passion was, my son or his business, because a week before he asked me, he read an article in the Margie Belay's column about my passion being my son's memorial scholarship funds. The employer told me that he thought that he was being fair to me with my regarding my son the last 2 years, but he was going to have to let me go because we had communication problems. And out of the 10 members of Eric and Ben's families that attended the funerals, the memorials, the pretrial hearings, and the trial, I was the only one let go of my job when I returned back to work. That's my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Plunkett. We appreciate you offering your testimony today. Good questions for any member of this panel? Okay. Thank you very much, all three of you. The last witness I had signed up was Steve Dole. Mr. Dole, was there anyone else here who intended to testify on this bill? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'm also here today representing Parents of Murdered Children, the Portland chapter. I'll make my remarks brief. You've heard a couple of stories. It's been my experience since I've been involved in crime victims' rights and crime victims' issues. I've seen these stories too many times over the last 8 years. Mary Elledge, who is president of Parents of Murdered Children, asked me to tell you that Parents of Murdered Children, the Portland chapter, that is supportive of this bill, as is Crime Victims United. The one story that I wanted to point out, and I promised one of our members that I would, and I know that at least two on the panel would recall this this murder that took place in Portland, murders, I should say, in 1998. There were the Larch Mountain murders. I know that Representative Barker would probably remember those, and so would Representative Williams. Two men set out on a Sunday morning to go target practicing in a place that was very popular for that in the Larch Mountain area. And while they were there target practicing, three young thugs, all under the age of 18, came upon them. The three young men had automatic weapons, and they opened fire on them. When they were later caught and asked why they did it, they basically said they did it for the thrill of it, for the rush. It was a thrill kill. Nothing more, nothing less. They were tried for aggravated murder and found all three found guilty. The wives of these two individuals together met with law enforcement, met with DAs, met with victims' assistants, attended the pretrial and also the trial, and finally the sentencing. Both of these women were discharged from their jobs after that experience, and it is just, in my mind, reprehensible. So we ask you to please pass this bill with the amendments. I want to thank Senator Brown for all of her hard work on this bill. We are indebted to her for it as crime victims, and again, we ask for your passage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any question for Mr. Dole? Okay, thank you very much. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 610. And I'll open a work session. Chair, Representative Brzezinski.
Moves SB 610 as presented to the committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves Senate Bill 610 A to the floor. Is there an amendment?
There's
no. Oh, the two amendments.
Five and six.
Mr. Chairman, I want to, I'm sorry,
Council,
I should have.
You want to talk about those?
Yes. Senator Brown spoke to one of these amendments. You should have two. There should be the A5 and the A6.
Right.
The A5 is just to deal with the oversight in the Senate, which was this.
Murder.
It was the aggravated murder. The A6 would make this applicable to any person felony as defined by the Criminal Justice Commission. Phil Lemon's here, and Phil put together this list that you should have on Criminal Justice Commission paper that would on the back lists all the person felonies. That expansion would make this apply to obviously a greater array of felonies. I can go through them. I know we're pressed for time. I'll only do that if anyone has any questions on those.
Let me make sure first that Representative Brzezinski, do you want to withdraw your motion?
Yes, I am withdrawing my motion this time.
All right. So what we have are the A5 and the A6 amendments. We've got the letter from Mr. Lemon that indicates that if you extend this to person felonies beyond just the original Measure 11 felonies that were provided in the original version of the bill, it would affect approximately an additional 3,000 to 5,000 cases per year in Oregon, is the estimate from the Criminal Justice Commission. So does anyone have any questions on that? Representative Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, from what I've heard counsel say, and what I've heard about this bill, it's not setting up where the employer is going to be obligated to make payment for time off. It's really the option of the individual victim or family member to ask for the time off on their own, and there's not going to be any compensation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, Section 6 of the bill deals with that, and what it says is an eligible employee who takes leave to attend a criminal proceeding may use any paid accrued vacation leave during the period of leave, or may use any paid leave that is offered by the covered employer in lieu of vacation leave during that period of leave. And of course, this is subject to any terms of any bargaining agreement. So they are not required in line 28, not required to grant leave with pay, okay, but they can use, you know, their accrued sick time. Leave and accrued time.
And Mr. Chair, if I could follow up one other, it's from what I heard counsel say, the A5s will take care of an issue that was neglected on the Senate side, and the A6 would be just broadening it beyond what the
right.
current bill does.
That's
right.
correct. And Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you choose to adopt the A6s, the A5s are not necessary because aggravated murder is a person felony.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley. Or, I'm sorry, Brzezinski.
It's here. I move the A6 in the Senate bill, 610A.
Representative Brzezinski moves the dash A6 amendments to Senate bill 610. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The A6s are in the bill. Representative Brzezinski.
Yes, I'll now move Senate bill 610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves Senate bill 610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Call the roll, Nancy.
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. Senate Bill 610A is amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll assign Representative Brzezinski to carry the bill. And finally, we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 59. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 59, we have back in committee, and we have the A5 amendment is, you should have the A4 and A5. The A5 supersede the A4s and were drafted for the same purpose. This, again, deals with firearms or other deadly weapons that have been taken by law enforcement because they were possessed, used, or available for use to facilitate a criminal offense. It deals with what can be done with those firearms. If you look at the A5 amendment and you look at line 21 to 24 on page 1, I think this is the change from the language that the bill had in its current form. The court shall release a firearm or other deadly weapon forfeited under subsection 2 of this section to the law enforcement agency that seized the weapon. The law enforcement agency may destroy or sell the weapon. That's the change. Use the weapon as a service weapon or use the weapon for training, identification, or demonstration purposes. And then the next portion on page 2, line 2, when a weapon is sold pursuant to this subsection, law enforcement agency shall pay the proceeds from the sale less the cost of the sale to the account of the law enforcement agency be to use for purposes of public safety, law enforcement, and crime prevention and detection. And then this is the one that we have basically a double amendment, so the next sections have the identical language.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 59.
Representative Jensen moves the dash A5 amendments to the bill. I wanted to, if it's Representative Jensen okay with you before we take a vote on that, I think there are a couple of people who came forward who might want to make some comments on the A5s and respond to some questions. Are you okay with that?
So happy with that.
So we'll keep your motion in, out and just in abeyance while we determine that. Ms. Vittelins, did you need to come forward and make any comment on the A5? I wanted to give you, you don't have to. I wanted to give you that. Yeah, I'm not going to make you, but I wanted to give you that opportunity. Anybody else here on the A5s? All right. No takers. All right. So the motion, the motion is back. Representative Jensen on the A5. Discussion, Representative Przanski.
Now, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure why the A5s are here. I understand, Representative Jensen, we had this discussion previously when we moved the SB 59A out the first time, and my understanding is that there's concern as to law enforcement being able to sell weapons that have been forfeited to it. And as I put on the record then, I want to put on the record now, there is a process for currently in law that allows for law enforcement to, in fact, take possession of firearms and then have those weapons forfeited through either criminal or civil forfeiture. And once the nexus has been demonstrated as a criminal conviction with the use of the weapon for a crime, then that weapon does in fact come and is forfeited to the agency. And it's my understanding at that point they can in fact sell the weapon if they so choose to do so. What the intent of SB 59 was originally brought forward was to take care of an issue that when we had the civil forfeiture law passed by the voters of this state, it also took in a current or a statute that was current at the time and stated that at that point those weapons could not be declared to be nuisances and then ceremoniously by the court forfeited to the agency, and what we were attempting to do was correct that problem so they would not have to use the forfeiture procedure for declaring these weapons nuisances and then having them either destroyed or used by the agency for training purposes, etc. And I guess I'd like some discussion because right now I'm not in favor of bypassing the civil or criminal forfeiture procedure that's in place currently, knowing that the civil forfeiture law was passed by the voters. I was one of the individuals that worked on that as the work group, and it's my belief and understanding that when we drafted that legislation, it was not to allow for weapons or other property to become property of a government agency and then to be sold without making it go through a due process of forfeiture, either, well, it was really for civil, and then the criminal forfeiture came about because of the civil forfeiture law being passed by the voters. And so I guess I'd ask Representative Jensen why he believes that we need to bypass the current procedure that does, in fact, allow law enforcement to obtain these weapons for the purpose, if they choose to sell them, and not go through the civil or the criminal forfeiture laws to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I'm just kind of a plain, simple country boy that reads the language of this original bill the way it's written. And the way it's written does not provide, in my opinion, the ability to do that. It says under this, firearms or other deadly weapons forfeited under this section must be destroyed or released to a law enforcement agency to be used only as a service weapon or for training, identification, demonstration purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Under the purposes of that, if it doesn't fall into any of those categories, it must be destroyed. That at least is the way that portion of the statute is written. That was the reason for it.
So if I could, I think what you're saying, Representative Przanski, is there is another forfeiture process which could be gone through in order to sell a weapon if they wanted to go through that process. And I think what Representative Jensen is saying is that if that's not the process they go through. But if they go through this expedited process, then there's really only two. There's only the use for training alternative or the destruction alternative. His point, I think, being that if you go through this process and the weapon is, and this doesn't exclude their ability to destroy it, it simply gives law enforcement then the opportunity to actually sell the weapon if they use this expedited process. And I would assume that in most cases that would only be if there was actually some realizable value in the ability to actually do that, that they wouldn't do it for most of what goes through the process. But if it was some antique valuable weapon, and this was the process that was used, that it still had that ability to sell. I think you're right, Representative Brzezinski, in the sense that more often than not, that will not be the process that's used if their intent is to sell the weapon. But at the same time, I don't know that it creates a significant a problem, as I indicated to you earlier. I didn't get any indication from counsel's office that, that this amendment ran afoul of the citizen passed measure, the number of which I can't remember now. Was it three?
Measure three.
So given that, I think, you know, it's just it's a two-track issue, and I think this is just allowing that provision. So that's where I think the two of you are maybe reading things differently.
And, Mr. Chair, I think you're correct. I mean, this is just expedites the ability for the guns to be forfeited through a quicker process than going through what the citizens and the intent of that civil forfeiture measure three called for. And that I'm just not ready to bypass and give an expedited process where I believe when we put the initiative together and the voters were presented that, it set specific bright lines of what had to happen before ownership took place and, in my opinion, for the actual sell or resell of these items back into the general public. Clearly, you know, when you look at the bill as it is written, was presented, and we had it on the floor to vote on, it does, in fact, limit what the specific uses can be when you use this expedited process. But if you choose or your desire is to sell an antique weapon or an AR-15, something that may have high-value Glocks, whatever they may be, I believe that the better process is, and one that's more true and informed to what the citizens passed, based on the intent of the drafters of the initiative and what I believe the criminal forfeiture statutes provide for based on the passage of the civil forfeiture, is that we should go through or just allow that process to happen, and then they can do whatever they want to with the weapon. This is just shortchanges it or cuts it short for designated purposes, which I fully support.
Well, Dinah has changed her mind now and would like to come forward. So we have either gotten something wrong or muddled our way into a quagmire. So welcome.
Thank you, Chair Williams. Dinah Vidalin's here from the Department of Justice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Organized Crime Section. Chair Williams, members of the committee, I just wanted to mention that this is not an expedited forfeiture process. It's really a criminal forfeiture and of a specific category of item weapons, because you're required to get a criminal conviction before you even reach the issue of forfeiture. And I guess the crucial thing is that we really need this statute, because we had what was ORS 166280 and previously 281, which was basically this statute. That was, in my opinion, inadvertently repealed when the criminal forfeiture statute was enacted. And this just provides a way for weapons that have been used to commit crimes and the individual has been convicted to get rid of them. And as far as the Department of Justice on what happens with the weapons, we think it's crucial that the weapon that we have the option to get weapons to the crime lab, to the state police crime lab, because they've really suffered in the last 2 years, because they use these weapons for training, identifying in crimes, all that kind of thing. As far as the other items, that's a policy decision for you guys to make, and Department of Justice does not have an opinion on that.
Okay.
Wait, I have a question before we bring anyone else up.
You may ask her your question, Representative.
You say, Diana, this is still a criminal forfeiture, and it's really just
putting back on the books what had originally been there. And my reading of the what was originally there, it was basically declaring those weapons as nuisances, and then they were basically being, use the word forfeited, but they were then directed to be destroyed or used or whatever it was by law enforcement. It, to me, is a different process than what's required under the forfeiture on the criminal side, where you have to plead and prove the weapon. At least that's my understanding of how the criminal forfeiture works. And on the civil forfeiture, you just have to have the conviction of the offense that's the nexus to the item that you want to have forfeited. Is that not correct?
Chair Williams, Representative Prozanski, the requirement in this case is a conviction of the underlying crime and that the weapon was used. I don't think that's any different in a criminal forfeiture proceeding. In fact, you could expand. You could say, I purchased this weapon with the money from a drug sale, and so it's a proceed, and I get to forfeit it. Under this statute, it's got to be used to commit the crime.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And prior to having either criminal forfeiture, which was a direct result of the citizens passing civil forfeiture, that wasn't the process, was it?
I guess I don't understand your question.
They didn't have to plead and prove that there was that the weapon was used in the offense. They basically had to get a conviction, such as someone unlawful possession of a firearm inside of a vehicle, and because they were in possession of the of a firearm when they were driving a vehicle, then the weapon could be determined by the court to be a nuisance, and then at that point it was ripe to being forfeited.
Chair Williams, Representative Prozanski, the only change between what we had before 166.281 and this is that instead of using the word nuisance, we've used the word contraband. And so the procedure is essentially the same. You must get a conviction. The weapon had to be used to commit the crime, and then you go forward with declaring it as contraband and it's forfeited.
Okay, Mr. Danke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to flag one other issue. I agree with Ms. Vidalin's characterization of the statute. It's this bill would create something in between a civil and a criminal forfeiture, but by adding the possibility of selling the weapon, you then have proceeds under this bill that would be dealt with differently than proceeds, that is, the clear proceeds, after either a criminal forfeiture or a civil forfeiture under current law. You may recall that under Measure 3, the proceeds post the sale of a from a civil forfeiture proceeding, which is now required to happen only after conviction, and that part is consistent with this bill. The prohibition in Measure 3 and in current civil forfeiture law prohibits the proceeds from being used for law enforcement purposes. This bill would allow the proceeds to be used, would require that the proceeds be used for law enforcement purposes. And even under criminal forfeiture provisions that were approved in 2001, only a portion of proceeds can be used for law enforcement purposes. So I would suggest respectfully to the committee that if you're going to move in the direction of the Dash 5 amendments, you should conform the use of the proceeds from the sale of any of these weapons to either the criminal forfeiture provisions or prohibit them from being used for law enforcement purposes. But in no case should more than, I believe it's 50% under the criminal forfeiture bill, be used for law enforcement purposes.
Ms. Vidalins, do you believe that, that this procedure, if we were to adopt the Dash A5 amendments, that it would prohibit the use of more than 50% of the proceeds from the sale of a weapon being used for law enforcement purposes, so the balance would have to be remanded consistent with that statute?
Chair Williams, no.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. I think we are at the point of Representative Jensen's motion to move the Dash A5 amendments. And with that, we will have Nancy call the roll.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Crummell.
Excused.
Pearson.
Excused.
Zonsky.
No.
Shatterly.
Excused.
Chair Williams.
Aye. Dash 85s are adopted in the bill. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 59 as amended. Dash 85 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves the dash, or Senate Bill 59 as amended by the Dash 85 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Representative.
That's fine. I'll be voting no on the motion to take this to the floor for the reasons stated before. I do find this to be in direct conflict of what the voters passed in Measure 3 as to the use of the proceeds, as well as what was agreed upon during the negotiations in the 2001 legislative session when criminal forfeiture was established. And that this now basically chips away again at the intent of the voters' passage of Measure 3 and now allows for 100% of the proceeds to be used by law enforcement, where they, in their vote, said none of the proceeds could be used by law enforcement.
Okay. With that, why don't we have a vote on the actual bill? Nancy?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Crummell?
Excused.
Pearson?
Excused.
Krasinski?
No.
Shatterly?
Excused.
Shatterly?
Aye. Senate Bill 59A is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Brzezinski, I can't have you be the carrier anymore.
Probably not.
I'm so, good. So for helping us out in this quagmire, I'm going to assign the bill to Representative Jensen to carry on the floor.
I appreciate the honor of having to do battle with Representative.
And with that, committee, it's been fun to be back together again, actually doing some work. So appreciate your assistance this afternoon, and we stand adjourned.